And we achieve this with services, stakeholder interaction, and the provision of relevant and implementable project standards. Our role in terms of the PFMA is to promote transparency in and effective financial management of revenue, expenditure, assets, and liabilities, and we have to set standards of generally recognized kind of practice as required by both the Constitution and the financial management legislation. We also prepare and publish guidelines and directives. We recommend an implementation date for these standards to the Minister of Finance and he consults the Auditor General about those proposed implementation dates. Now, we contribute to all of the presidential outcomes, but the main ones are the achievement of a responsive, accountable, effective and efficient local government system and an efficient and effective development-oriented public service. What are we trying to achieve? We are trying to ensure that financial statements are prepared in accordance with a specific reporting framework, i.e. GRAP, so that everybody that prepares the financial statements use the same protocols to enable you to make decisions. If we have relevant, credible and consistent information, it enhances accountability, comparability, and enables streamlined guidance and capacity building initiatives. So when we set standards, we design them with the objective of enhancing accountability and decision making, and we prepare it for a specific group of users, i.e. those that contribute resources to government and those that are recipients of government services and their representatives, i.e. members of parliament and the legislature. Our impact on the economy, by providing guidance for reporting of financial and performance information, when it's implemented and audited, it ensures that the public obtains credible information and builds public confidence, and it also enables decision-making and accountability. It also promotes investment in that builds confidence in government and ultimately has an impact on the credit rating. But it's more, we have a more direct impact on policy decisions in that when you have reliable and credible information, you can make policy decisions and you can make policy choices between different priorities and requests for funding. It's also used for statistical purposes by the IMF for government financial statistics and by the United Nations for the System of National Accounts. Who is the AFB? We are a public entity. We report directly to the National Treasury. We have 10 board members who are appointed by the Minister of Finance of consultation with the Auditor General. Board members are required to have two functions. On the one hand, they have to be technical experts in accounting, and on the other hand, they have to, as the accounting authorities, they're responsible for the governance of the entity. The 10 board members that we have at the moment have an appropriate set of skills. There's a representative from the Office of the Auditor General, the Accounting General, some of the large auditing firms, municipalities, national and provincial governments. All the members except the auditor representative from the Auditor General and the Accounting General are non-executive and are appointed in their individual capacity. They are remunerated for attendance of meetings and they are not full-time employees of the board. Who uses the standards? At the moment, it has been implemented by Parliament, and as a result of legislation that's promulgated last year, all the legislatures will also now use the same standards. All the municipalities and their entities have implemented, all the constitutional institutions. At the moment, Schedule 3A and 3C, my apologies, that's a mistake on there, entities are required to comply, as well as trading entities, and the Minister of Higher Education decided that public FET colleges should also implement banners of that. Who is not using it at the moment? basically national and provincial departments and the treasury, because they have to, they are busy with the integrated financial management system, and as soon as it's been completed, they will implement. Schedule 2 entities, that's the major public entities like Transnet, the NAL, those entities, they do international financial reporting standards, that's the private sector equivalent. And then Schedule 3 B&B, in terms of the legislation, has to apply South African Statement of Generally Accepted Accounting Practice, that was the amendment of the New Companies Act that was promulgated. Statement of Gulf are now withdrawn. And so at the moment we have an exposure box where we're proposing that those entities also change to standards of practice. We expected, I think there's another 2 months left over of that consultation process before we'll make a recommendation to the board. I've got a very busy slide there just to briefly explain the standard setting process. I'm not going to go through it. But the aim of the slide is really to demonstrate that at each stage of the standard setting process, we consult. It is very important that we get input from preparers, from users, from auditors, and anybody else that has an interest in the standard. I think the one thing that's not on that slide is the responsibility of a standard setter to assess whether the standards that they've developed have been implemented and have achieved the effect that was intended. And last year we did our first post-implementation review of two standards, standard on investment property and standard on property, plant and equipment. We used a number of methods to consult, including questionnaires, face-to-face meetings, roundtables, workshops, and it was very extensive, and the objective was to consult key users of the financial statements and the preparers. We looked at both internal in departments and external to government when we looked at the users. General observations we had was that education initiatives are needed, that users do not necessarily understand the information that they receive in financial statements and needed more training in that regard on how to use it and how to make decisions with it. That there's a requirement that the reporting in strategic plans, budget, financial statements, and reports on performance is aligned, so we're talking about same information. And there was, in some cases, a request for additional reporting requirements. From the preparers, the input was generally positive. I believe that the implementation of those two specific standards have helped them to improve how they manage their assets. There are still concerns about the cost to implement, the skills necessary to comply, the capacity issues, and the IT issues around them, both for statements and, for example, asset management. I've identified some practical application and interpretation issues that we're looking at, and I've also identified where there are differences and disagreements with auditors. As a result of the post-implementation review, we've identified a number of projects that we are adding to our work program, the first of which is a discussion paper on applying materiality in preparing financial statements. That discussion paper has now been published and is available for comment. It has a 6-month comment period. It's a very controversial issue and is trying to enable preparers to actually apply their minds when preparing financial statements and not just have a compliance mindset and make it a tick-box approach to ensuring that they disclose everything the important issues in the financial statements are lost among all that comes. We are also reviewing the two standards. We're trying to improve the distinction that needs to be made between investment property and property, plant and equipment. We're looking at an indicator approach to assessment of the useful lives. So instead of having to review all the useful lives of assets every year, you would only perform a review when you have triggered some of those indicators. There has been a request for improved disclosure of capital work in progress. Users say it's just a single figure in the financial statements and then there's what's in there and it needs to be unpacked. and then we also review some of the disclosures. We're making amendments to Grad 1, which is statements on presentation of financial statements. And users that have asked for more information about affairs and maintenance, particularly also whether improvements to assets are resulting in increases in capacity to deliver service, or whether it's just maintenance of existing capacity. And then looking at the recognition of land. A lot of land is a big issue because, one, it's not always registered in the name of the department, it's normally registered in the name of public works. Sometimes they use the property, but they don't own the property, and do they need to account for it? And then with the number of arrangements for the development of social housing, and they're not always, particularly in the municipalities, are not always certain whether they're acting as the contractor, whether they're the actual just an agent in those cases, or the provincial or national department. So we're going to look at all those arrangements and try to provide best guidance. And then you're also reviewing the two standards on impairment of assets to ensure that they are adequate to deal with the issues that the municipalities particularly offer. Other projects that we're working on at the moment is a project on living and non-living natural resources, and what the extent of reporting in that regard should be in financial statements. We issued a discussion paper, an exposure draft, on how to report your relationships when you're acting as a principal versus when you're acting as an agent. Again, because of our structure of government, municipalities are often required to do work for national and provincial departments, and they're not all to perform functions for those departments. Or other departments are performing functions for, say, national departments, like the collection of fines, the post offices doing a lot of administrative activities for other departments. SASA is working on behalf of the Department of Social Development. So all these activities need to be disclosed in the financial statements, but they don't always know whether they're acting as principal or whether they're acting as agent. And this standard is intended to try and help them make that distinction, and so hopefully result in a more appropriate disclosure. Big issue is accounting for social benefits by government. It's not a South African issue, but it's an international issue at the moment. There is no guidance in that regard on how it should be accounted. Most of governments are accounting for it on a pay-as-you-go basis without looking at what is the liability in relation to those social benefits that are granted. Should they be accounted for similar to, say, employees for pension for employees, or is this a different natural fish that we need to account for completely differently? But we're participating in the international project in that regard. The issue that we still need to work on is expenditure arising from non-exchange transactions. We have a standard on recognition of revenue from non-exchange transactions. A lot of that revenue is transfers from other levels of government. And the question is, how should the expense be accounted for when such a grant is allocated to another entity? The revenue standard needs revision, and the leases standard needs revision. So those are current key projects. In the invitation for us to make this presentation, you said you should indicate to you areas where we would need your assistance and advocacy. One of the areas is scope creep, and what we mean by that is financial statements are part of the annual report, but increasingly departments and other entities are requiring additional information to be disclosed in annual reports. And the problem is that they want the information to be credible, and therefore they believe that if it's in the annual report it will be audited. But that's not necessarily the case. And therefore they develop requirements to include it in the annual report. The problem with that is, depending on where it's positioned in the annual report, it won't be audited. It's only audited if it's part of the performance information or the other financial statements itself. In addition, annual reports are supposed to provide information for general purposes for those users who do not have the ability to get information directly from the entity. So it's for you, for example. Because, I mean, some of the things you can ask for directly from a department, and they have to provide that information to you. But the information is also for example, credit agencies, invested in government bonds and things like that. So it can't just be a single user that needs that information. It's not the right place for it. And so we need to watch what we put in there, because annual reports get bigger and bigger, these people will read them and they become useless. And they don't serve the purpose that was intended. Secondly, we need to be able to consult you, particularly, for example, during a post-implementation review, where we need to understand what information are you using in the financial statement, and what are the decisions that you make in regards to that information, and generally, be able to consult you when you issue documents, because it's ultimately you are the representatives of both health providers and the recipient services. And so if the information we require to be disclosed in financial statements don't help you in filling that function, then it's wasting everybody's time. Finally, there's an issue regarding financial statements versus financial reporting. If you look at the financial statements, it really deals with the statement of financial performance, the statement of financial position, the cash flow statement, and the notes. The performance information outside the financial statement, even though the auditors provide assurance on that. And that's, at the moment, the difference between financial statements and financial reporting in our annual report. We also have other information reports by the executives about the various programs and performance against those programs. We have information on human resources, governance, and all kinds of things. But those things are not financial reporting. And the question is, should we be developing standards to deal with information that is financial reporting but not financial statements? Now, if we go back to that one of the earlier slides, we have to provide, our focus right now provides financial reporting guidelines on revenue, expenses, assets and liabilities. And all of that encompasses service delivery and performance information. So we believe that our scope is wide enough, but that is uncertainty generally about whether or not there needs to be standards on reporting of other information. For example, the question of comparison with budgets, reporting on performance is the one thing, reporting on financial discussion and analysis, on long-term sustainability of government, and those kinds of things. And what we have requested the National Treasury when we commented on a previous draft of the Finance Management Act to clarify that exactly what our role is. We understand that there are departments that are specifically responsible, for example, for performance management. And we do not want to impede whatever they're doing. But they are developing the requirements for how to measure performance. What we are interested in is the standard on how to report that information in the financial statement. At the moment, you get everything, and that's not really helpful to you, because it needs to be clearer on whether or not they've achieved the objectives. I hope I've made it clear and that I haven't confused you, because I think I'm confusing myself.
I think the big issue that will hit the community in the next 2 years is government Currently, local government is applying the standard, and government is on a cash basis system of accounting. And the move with the introduction of the integrated financial management system, are we going to move government to an accrual basis? And it's a big issue internationally, and the G20 is also dealing with that. Most governments are still on a cash basis, but the minute you go on an accrual basis, you also recognize huge liability, which means that you bring quite a lot of things on the balance sheet in terms of assets and liabilities. And so some of these liabilities could be quite huge and not easily measurable. And hence, governments are also kind of reluctant to go the accrual route. But it might be a very fundamental question that South Africa has to deal with. When do we go at the provincial and regional government level, go on accrual basis? But what could also be quite important for us to make that decision is the capacity of our people to actually go on a accrual basis. And when we look at public account standards in universities, it's not covered. So therefore, we would not be able to make a decision without making sure that we have capable people who can actually, who are schooled in these standards and have a public sector perspective for them to be able to then apply the standards. So therefore, advocacy around capacity building and education, so engaging with the Department of Higher Education and the national, the new school of government will become quite an important kind of advocacy for the community before we can make the decision of going to the accrual basis of accounting. So those are the comments.
Yeah, so for example, I think I know, but I'm not sure. What is the difference between the sessions? What are the benefits of practice? Basically, you can point to the world. Well, the way one is not.
Thank you. On the cash basis, you recognize the transactions, then you actually make the payment or receive the cash into your bank account. On the accrual basis, you recognize activities when the economic activity takes place, so when the service delivery takes place, when you receive the goods even before you've actually used them. So on the cash basis, if you look at a balance sheet or statement of financial position, you will only have cash and reserves. To also as ownership equity or something like that. But on an accrual accounting, you have a balance sheet that has receivables, payables, amounts owing to the revenue fund, amounts owing to or owed by other departments or entities. In a hospital, for example, you will have patient bills for medical services that have been rendered. You will have payments due to suppliers of services. You have the liabilities to your employees for leave and for bonuses and things like that in the financial statement. Under the cash basis, you don't recognize any of those kinds of things. It's like looking at the egg. On the cash basis, it's the yolk of the egg. On the accrual basis, it's the whole egg because it's all of that that is at an end in the service or something like that.
And the impact on that is that when you are looking at the cash basis, when I have cash, I'm going to pay something. But it might not show you the extent on which you are liable for things. So because when you don't have the cash, you don't show it, but you might be liable, but because you don't have the cash to actually engage on something, then you don't show it because you only recognize it when you pay for the expense. So it's like when you had a salary, you've worked in a month. But if I don't pay you, I won't show you that I've paid salary. But actually, I owe you a salary. So the accrual basis says, I need to recognize that I owe you the salary, not because I've paid you.
Mm-hmm.
So currently, we're just working things. When I pay you, I recognize that I've paid you. But I might owe you for so many months. And in our book, the government, we do not necessarily, on the balance sheet, show that.
Mm-hmm.
We show it in the notes to say, when you look at the statements in national government and provincial, you can see it in the notes, but you don't show it on the face of the financial statement. So that's the That's a major difference.
Okay, thank you very much. Now, all the members.
Thank you, and I want to welcome the input that was made or the presentation that was made by ALG. I think I have a few questions to ask you. One which is very interesting is what has been outstanding on the switch from graph to from what? From by public institutions, provincial and local government. It's something that has been outstanding, I think, even when you are. The same because there's this thing that government wants to appoint itself into or integrate, so it will still take time for them to teach into that. But and the other biggest problem is the capacity going forward. Because if you look currently on how and of course we know PFMA and MFMA talk of accounting officers, but they too rely on PFMA. And I know in municipalities there's always been info where CFOs from all over come together and say codes of good practice and other things. But if you look at the accounting standards of municipalities currently, the framework and other things, and also ask yourself whether it's information any impact and whatever. And what kind of support does your entity then assist in making sure that proper capacities built in CFOs. Of course, we expect them, as they assume that responsibility, that actually they have what is required for a chief financial officer. But in most cases, the contrary is what we experience. I mean, if you look at the commitment of someone to say, achieving clean audits by 2014, and if you look at currently where we stand, whether national, provincial, or municipality, very big departments go through clean audits, or even at least closer to unqualified. So the fact that we still have the same and other things talks more to the financial system. Something that you guys are looking at. And the capacity that you want to see the community around this thing. So once we get this favor, we know the AG could not even make sense on the financial statement that a particular department has for. So it's a warning factor for us as committees that play over that. And I know Koba will be coming in a member of Koba is here with us who has not told the chair that he's committed to today. But and I think it's one of the things that I think should be very close to your problem. The other challenge here, I saw them picking up the issue of assets registers and other things, because it's one of the things that are very critical, not only land and other things, because the issue of asset register cuts across all public structures and public entities. The one interesting area which I came across in my other responsibility was the issue of biological assets. Animals in agriculture, game in economic development or tourism and other things. And I'm not sure. And CFOs are betting. So one of the things that the accounting standards board should also look at is that area which also becomes very problematic for our CFOs and other things. The other issue that we also touched on is the issue of revenue. I know AG sometimes punishes departments because of under collection. And two, 3 days ago, as this committee, when we're engaging on other things and engaging with staff, there was also an element of saying in other areas, staff is underperforming in as far as revenue collection is concerned. And I think it was on issues of what the mining houses are contributing and the disclosures that they are making after paying all their overheads and other things and so on and so on. And those are the areas where we also have to dig in and see whether our public entities and provincial departments are equal to the task in making sure that government gets what it should to them. So your accounting standard practice should also be able to assist our departments to be able to deal with that. So far, check. I think those are my issues. My critical area is capacity of CFO as we teach them to grow. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. My question is probably a theoretical one, but that's a still political contribution. The concept of demodi. Is it a correct concept? Because in my view, it says no matter when you are saying, I mean, politicians often come up with all these different concepts, operation, clean audit, but at the end of the day, you are working with something, and it can happen that this year you can use your facility and select a particular sample and arrive at different results from the results that you arrived at the previous year. Is this a correct concept? Because I think, on the other hand, I think as politicians, we are saying ourselves with that concept of clean audit. Should we not be fixing more on the unqualified, with no interest of net or whatever? It's not a radical, but just political implications, because I think we bought into the concept of clean audit, and let's to me, it's not there. But secondly, I also wanted to check with you whether is there something that we are doing. Obviously, we have to as you were rightly pointing out, that our adherence and complying with international standards is also good for our credit rating and so forth. But at the same time, I'm also looking at what you are doing there. Also trying to confront your own reality and the country. Is there some research that you are probably looking at? I will give you a very good example. We have traditional leaders, and that is a major, I mean, when I was the chair of COPA, we had serious problems with them having to comply with the calibrated standards that try for the policy. Number one, you will find that, you know, the trade paper is the kind of its performance is often a bit of a challenge there. And there are all sorts of protocols that must be followed. I mean, you would probably have recalled how we had deep right to be in court, if you look at my mind, I don't know that because they simply say, you know, how dare you come to me and say nothing. Now, I'm saying these are some of the challenging issues that we are confronted, and probably the most appropriate body to start engaging to address it. Because at the end of the day, AG, that's the standard that are generated from you and obviously of those standards, they use those standards. So it starts with you, that's where it starts. And the other thing that I also wanted to say, as a former CEO of SALCA, I will tell you something. One of the things that I observed with Minister Chanji is that because there isn't anything that, you know, the way our standards are crafted are such that where there have been improvements, even if you have not yet arrived at your unqualified audit or whatever, but there have been some improvements, whether you had received the other audit opinion, but now, you know, you are trying to sort out your information and you are getting your papers. But progress he made. And in that way, he actually made people well, anyway, I'm going to be getting it as a man, so I might as well just be in that thing and forever, you understand? I mean, I've said that kind of frustration. I'm not sure if you have already said that kind of frustration. But finally, the last question is that wherever age you go, there is always a question about aging. You are telling us that this means qualified people and unqualified on this opinion, but there's not such delivery. They're looking very good, you know, in terms of that pronouncement. But there's no such delivery. They unqualified on this opinion, they said to say, well done. They're doing the qualified as well. But on the ground, they've done oppositionally. Is there anything self-standard that is now trying to bridge this gap of the practical reality of the impact of that opinion on the actual census, that's a couple of should be rendered, and finally the change. There is also something that has been a turning issue with us as when our cliche of the future payment system was done. We have a challenge where, you know, even now, I know that the Department of Social Development has a big problem because they receive the money from National Treasury. It comes to them, and when it gets there, it then gets transferred into SASA. But then SASA has had a major, there was one of the stories of the information was sent down or whatever. Now, this is really what it is because it's not necessarily them, but the disclaimer is going as a monetary channel. They are not necessarily, they are not there responsible for the information there. What happens in that case? And what happens in a case where there is standard that is tracking as well, their interest? Because what we are saying, remember that we are transferring more than 10 billion, SASA is transferring more than 10 billion to the service provider. And when they are transferring that 10 billion, obviously there is that period where this money is floating somewhere. How do we, who that interest, who can pass to? And is there a way in terms of the standards that can track something like that? Thank
you. No, I'm fine.
Okay, it's a bit in the front. What have you done to you there?
No, I'm going to go
Yeah. phase of those discussions.
Yeah.
I think we just call this phase coming out of the public.
Coming out of the
public. Well, that's one. You coming out of the public is a huge topic. at that time, the problem never been considered. The way last one was considered by the committee, you know. The person who's been in this committee is very late to this, who's been here in the top 10, for full term. David has been in the room for this term. So, that's right. Yeah, the way last one. But anyway, the thing to say is that, you know, think of the issues that the members raise, are really good issues. They also apply to the next interest by the politicians, or, in fact, they were the responsible. So, do you cooperate, a lot of people cooperate, but what extent are you working together, and should we be working more effectively together? So, the most general conversation from that perception I can ask, if I mean that word, one measure, surely, I don't think I love anything on you. One measure, amongst others, of your performance to show you how well you are doing in terms of public outcome. And if you look at where things are in all things here, particularly local government, we are still lagging in politics. I don't think it's strong enough to think that we truly generalize and exactly what you're going to do. Then it may be my own preoccupation, but not terms of use, I don't understand. I think I'll get to know. You know, I don't really understand what you mean by living and not living, that's not the best thing. Extensive arrangements and not exchange, whatever that means. And that's not your job. Instead of something that you care as a researcher, you know, you will be able to maybe put my issue. But what I do want to ask you is, why don't you put your story from which fact you should probably take a part? You talk about accounting standards to facilitate high quality information. I don't know if you talk about who uses such information to be. You talk about recipients of government services. Who do you mean by that? Now, I know some engineers that get money. So who exactly? So think about that. I think I'll take a risk because I want to be influenced again by the very system to start. I hope that a person will always be possibly subject to the issue. I think it's very well taken. The best policy is to mind maybe I'm wrong, but I don't know if that's not really a mind question. It's not important. So I think the questions are asked already and the comments made are more useful than anything I'm going to say of the other things I want to say. But we have to leave this meeting a slight understanding. Not for what, but maybe we go from here. Yeah. I want members to apply their mind to this thing, because I don't want us to call people here. And then we make us feel like we really want to engage with them, we accept them to 25 hours a day, and the next time we see them 2 years. So we will come back to all entities that fall within our portfolio around the middle of September. We are going to meet in the middle of August and for a month to work on our program. Parliament required us to have a program up to the end of the year. But what I think members should do is we have a lot of strategy. The strategy is not something that I'm about. It's an approach, a plan, a perspective. That we can involve.
Yeah.
We're not going to do a 5-year program. So I think we will not, if there's some noise that we believe and what everybody tells me is this committee and justice are so far, are the things worth committing, so to speak, for members because of the owner of the program. So we don't want to an open and not come to the end ground. This is the way you are. I think we're here. You will be very strange. I'm not going to cover the ground on what he's doing. What we're going to do is sort of like in ages from now, and we will come with an overall strategy. As for a program, that will come around January 30th.
Yeah.
But what we are seeking to do for our colleagues is appoint members. I don't know how we do this, right? These things are always on the majority side. The community that I chair, where we have specialists in each area. So we have active substance to the community chair and all the committee members, so not the committee for ANC, but to be the majority, but you can engage with one or two people, right? What we want to do is allocate 2 persons, maybe 2 of these committees, so you can reach them, and then they will process issues. We have an activist committee. So, what I'm saying is, we don't want to get sloppy eyes, sloppy eyes. Somehow we're going to leave every 2 weeks and we're going to sit here and look at the same work. You know, any of the courses, the general purpose is going to help you, but actually, and so on. Within that framework that we've provided, and the questions are asked, we're not expecting to provide every time in the course. It's getting a sense, a feel.
Yeah.
And probably the right word, feel, a process, you know, a feel, a sense of the sharing. That's what we're going to do in the framework. And then we'll be clear about what we're going to do and the work of the future.
Just to maybe use an analogy of the different roles that we play. So in this financial reporting, there's three key players being the accounting standard board, the national treasury, and the auditor general.
Yeah.
So let's use a musical analogy. So the accounting standard board writes the music. This is what should be done. The national treasury brings together the choir and the band, make sure that they perform the music. Mm. The auditor general comes at the end to say, this is how they perform. Yeah. So now, national treasury then has to look.
It's a very simple analogy for me, and I'm finding that it's very good.
And so now
you know, what more can you ask?
And then when we then look and say the capacity of the people to actually think lies with treasure to make sure. So we then can say, are we writing this music to be too complex? And that's what we look at. That's why we're doing this review of are people actually understanding the outcome. And so going to the question, should we be measured by the audit outcome? Well, if it needs to be looked at to say, did we write it simply enough, we start losing the truth because that melody needs to be kept.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
So we can't simplify to the point that it kills the melody. So it still must be kept intact.
Yeah.
And national treasury then gets measured to saying what are the resources you're putting to make sure that people can actually read the music, can actually sing. And then the auditor general can then give input to say, from what I've looked at, this is what you still missing. And the annual report that the auditor general puts together does allow to say, okay, yeah, the concept of the clean audit, to saying that on the financial side, we find, but however they were finding, that might not change the opinion that need to be cleaned up. And that's why it would not be a clean audit. And so that is an ongoing engagement to say, is that maybe the appropriate concept to still utilize, given the capacity? And I think we cannot be able to give a definitive answer on that because we have a trilateral where we meet with Auditor General, the National Treasury, and ourselves and discuss these issues. We meet every quarter, but every Wednesday there's technical meetings that take place between the Auditor General, especially around interpretation issues, how the Auditor General will be auditing some of the issues and so forth. So there's interaction on a regular basis between the three parties so that we make sure that at the end of the day, we three of us are responsible for the financial credibility of what gets reported, what gets produced. And therefore, that's why we need to have that constant engagement. And so, at the same time, we don't want to overstep our role in terms of now trying to tell Treasury what to do with capacity building, but we can be able to give input, but the actual performance of the job would need to be done by actual Treasury. And the Auditor General also has to maintain his independence to make sure that there's that credibility. And so they can give input, but Treasury is the one that has to actually implement. And so when it comes to the advocacy role, the quality would play an important role in making sure that the capacity building does happen. In terms of, is there a pipeline of people, going back to the question of the capacity building of the CFOs, what are we doing to capacitate the CFOs? What are the minimum qualifications the CFOs should have before they can actually do the ESP appointment? And to a certain extent, in the municipal area, there has been work in that area to say must be minimum capacity, qualification for municipal ministers and CFO. So we're going in that right direction. So the advocacy role that the committee can play is to encourage the building of that pipeline. Because when you have that pipeline, then you know that when we then move over to accrual basis, we will be actually avoiding being climbing, because we know that we have the capacity. But before then, we will actually have so much teething problem if we don't have the capacity to move over, I mean to handle the move over. So it's a very delicate kind of question. So capacity for us would be a primary capacity building, a primary advocacy role, and engaging with the educational, the university to say they must have public financial education prioritized, because currently the CA would only be confined using the private sector, but there is no specific program for the public sector. And when you look at the economic impact of the public sector, it is huge.
Yeah.
So there is quite a lot of capacity that can actually be built around that. So for us, this would be the primary role for the advocacy of the committee. And perhaps on the issues, because we've been working on the question on the agent and principal, there's a project within the accounting standards for it deals exactly with that issue. If you're an agent and a principal and you receive money to give to the recipient, being in the agency situation would be the grant receiver, like your old age grant or the maintenance for the young kids. So those would be the recipients of the services. So there are standards that we've built around how we account for that. And maybe Anna can expand on that and as well on the biological assets and heritage assets. And heritage assets, we came up with that standard and that's being used internationally. Because we've been able to say, these are the issues that we face in South Africa. How can we recognize our heritage assets? And that became a standard that was then applied in other countries. And we are doing the same around natural resources. How do we account for animals? How do we account for mineral resources? And we're working on that project. And maybe Erna can give more input around that.
I think the first issue that was asked is what are we doing about the transition from cash to accrual, etc. Now, every time a new type of entity applies standards, we develop a directive that indicates to them how long do they have to comply with the requirements and standards, what do they need to recognize in the first year, the second year, and the third year. So for municipalities, they were divided into high, low, and medium capacity, and we gave them a directive on how they need to make that change. Unfortunately, one of the things that was done was they could recognize all the assets, recognize some of the assets as one rand, and they stuck to that. The intention was to recognize it as one rand, but then to go and measure them appropriately and bring them in at the appropriate values, but they haven't moved past that. So that's one of the reasons that they do get disclosure and qualification. We have talked about that here, that's incredibly important. We cannot provide a lot of support. We are 6 full-time employees at the ASB. The board is the part-time body. We have appeared before you once before when the current Minister of Finance was the chair. Our annual report does get tabled every year, and we've always had team audit on Tuesday. I think so. I agree with you. I think our shared concern was with the term team audit. I think it implies that everything is going well in that entity. And we know, for example, Middelburg received the team audit premier, and on the same day that they had the announcement of the service delivery process, which brings me to the issue that we identified as the difference between financial statements and financial reporting, is how should we be reporting on performance information and service delivery in the financial statements? What is the nature of that report rather than just seeing all the performance indicators in the financial statements? So that's something we need to work on. Yes. Gene audit is a term that was coined by politicians according to the audit general. And it's really to say that there are no issues around internal control, financial management, all of those issues. But it is, I think that in some cases the cost to comply outweighs the benefits from getting a clean audit, and you need to acknowledge that you cannot implement some very expensive system at the cost of citizenry in order to get clean audit. So those trade-offs need to be made in making that decision. And if that's the decision that was made, then it needs to be disclosed so people understand why that's the case. If you would rather have an emphasis of matter, for example, than have a clean audit and at the expense of your personal objectives. So it's something that needs to be looked at in the way in which we report. And particularly when you look at the auditor's report and the information that we try to communicate. Because we do not recognize that there are improvements being made and issues being addressed. It's all or nothing. And that is the foundation, I agree with you. We mentioned the agent in principle. We have got a standard that deals with the interest. There are specific requirements with regards to interest. If it's for a grant, for example, the terms of the grant normally indicates whether the recipient of the grant can get the interest or whether they have to repay it. So there are specific terms and conditions around interest. But there is the disclosure of that, and all the information should be transparent in the financial statement. Because of the size of us and because of our mandate, we cannot get involved in dysfunctional entities at all. What we do is we take the general report of the auditor general. We also look at the specific issues that come through the weekly meetings on audit mandate to assess where are the problems and is there something that we can do to try and assist. Right,
I'm not
sure. Thank you. My board would agree with you to switch it off. During the weekly meetings and the general report that I issued, we analyze that to determine what kind of interventions can we develop. For example, we have a series of frequently asked questions with a proposed answer on how to deal with that. At the moment, municipalities are struggling with how to recognize revenue from fines. And so we are developing a frequently asked question to give environment. There's a standard and there's an interpretation that clearly sets out what is required, but they need more practical guidance, which is what the National Treasury should be developing. But in this case, we are trying to assist by making it more quickly available. And that's really why we have those quarterly meetings, is to make sure that everybody provides the necessary interventions that can be made within the time frame. One question is, who are the users, who are the resource providers and the recipients of services? Resource providers are people that pay the taxes, that provide, they invest in government bonds, that provide services, i.e. the employees, everybody who is participating in the economy and contracts with government. And recipients of services are, again, people of the country, people that get grants, people that get any other benefits directly or indirectly from government. And then their representatives are parliament, legislature, the municipal council, those people that are elected by the citizens to represent them. And so the information that we require to disclose in terms of financial statements are supposed to be there to assist you in making those, in performing that activity of oversight over the funds entrusted to all spheres of government. Yeah, so I think I've answered most of them. No, it's at once.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Good morning. Good morning. Good morning, Mr. Parliament. My name is Amanda Gallus. I'm from the Independent Regulatory Board for Auditors. And we've handed out the presentation together with our integrated report. It's now our annual report, which has been tabled in Parliament every year. But I've just brought the integrated report with me. My apologies for the board member that was meant to join, Mr. Iqbal Khan. He had a death in the family, so he unfortunately could not join the report. Chair, I was privy to the previous presentation and conversation, so I was hoping that we were also one of those best kept secrets, but already I've heard the comment that it's the first time that the members have seen myself and hear about the RBA. So hopefully after today you'll know a little bit more about us. I also gathered from the previous presentation that you probably want us to tell you what we need from Treasury and what we need from the committee.
Yeah.
So during my presentation, which covered all of that, I will deal with those issues. But I'll also, on my last slide, deal with possible requirements that the committee might have from us, and if we can support a committee. And hopefully, although you mentioned that we shouldn't expect to be engaging with a committee too often, I am hoping that once you know what we can do to assist support the committee, that you will engage with us where necessary. I'm just going to have a very short presentation and then I'll leave more time for questions. I'll start off by explaining the role of audit, the importance of audit. I heard a lot of comments about the Auditor General, so I'll also cover our relations with the Auditor General, with National Treasury and with the Accountant General. I'll then talk about the specific role of the IRBA, the impact that the IRBA has, our global positioning. I'll give you some statistics. And then I'll deal with some issues that are facing the profession and some issues that are facing the RBA. I'd rather say issues that are the agenda of the RBA, because it's not anything that we don't already have solutions to. That will really be the basis of my presentation. Let's start off by going straight to the role of audits in the economy. As you can see, there are various constituencies that rely on audits. Banks, for example, foreign companies, pension funds, lawyers, and various other entities in the economy rely on an audit so that they can have assurance, their members can have assurance, investors can have assurance, other regulators, international investors can have assurance of the state of affairs of that entity. Now, to summarize our mission and our role in the greater economy, our vision really is to create continuing value through our role as an embedded protector of confidence in the sustainability of the system. And by that we mean that the RBA is not only a standard setter, that's auditing standards, and a regulator of auditors. We believe that we have a bigger role to play in the greater economy. And hopefully by our presentation we'll know exactly where we fit into the greater economy. While at the same time we have to create an enabling environment for auditors, thereby contributing to the protection of South African public. And I think there's sometimes confusion about the role of the RBA. We are not protector of auditors, we are a protector of the public. And often the public thinks that we are there to protect auditors, but it doesn't mean that we don't support auditors. If we don't work together with auditors, issue guidance, we will not obtain the quality in the audit that we expect, because it's only through the delivery of high quality audits from auditors that we can protect the public. So we have to work together with them at some stage. It doesn't mean that we protect the public and don't do anything for auditors. We also need to support them. That point also became very clear last time I appeared in Parliament when I was asked a question about our response to the Company Act, and my immediate response was that it was the profession's responsibility to respond to it and not the RBA. The members were very unhappy because they felt that the RBA still was a custodian of the profession. And therefore our role is twofold. First and foremost, as per our mandate, to protect the public against auditors, but at the same time to support the auditors. From the diagram you can also see where we position ourselves. We have got interface with the public. The public lodges complaints to the RBA if they have a problem with auditors. We have to interact with auditors and at the same time report to the Minister of Finance, and therefore we have to engage with government. We need guidance from government and we also need support from government in various aspects which I'll cover a bit later. how do we regulate the OGA itself, what they do? We're one of the very few professions that regulate the people in profession. We don't call them members because members belong to a professional body, we're not a professional body. And we're one of the few professions that actually regulate what we call registrants. And although there's always a lot of resistance against regulation, I think everybody understands the benefits of regulation. If the profession wasn't regulated, then the public couldn't have any confidence in the quality of the product delivered by that professional person. We regulate through performing robust inspections. So we inspect our auditors. Every auditor is inspected on a cyclical basis. We investigate the conduct of auditors. So if we become aware of an auditor that has been involved in with a client where there has been problems, and we can become aware of it through what we read in the press, through the media, through anybody from the public lodging a complaint, or maybe our inspection to have some findings that necessitate the auditor to be sent for an investigation. We also have adopted international standards, which we are sometimes criticized for, but you will see the benefits of having adopted those international standards. But we also influence international standards. We participate in international structures so that the standards that we eventually adopt have actually been influenced by South Africa, and our anti-SAC requires that we use international standards. But instead of slaves to following the international standards, we actually actively influence those standards. We are responsible for registering, educating and training of auditors, which means that unless you qualify, meet the minimum requirement to be an auditor, you cannot be allowed to register as auditors perform a public function. So although accountants are not regulated by us, the reason auditors have to register with the RBA to regulate it is because they perform a public function. The public relies on information that's signed up by the auditor, and therefore it becomes a public responsibility. Through the regulation of auditors, it must create confidence with investors, both locally and internationally. If investors didn't have the confidence that the financial statements that they use to invest their money, if they want to invest in South Africa, if they weren't confident that they were reliable and the opinions on those financial statements were in fact the right opinion, then it would be difficult for them to make economic decisions. So it's important that they have the confidence in the whole system of regulation of auditors before they can make investments. In fact, our legislation says that through our regulation of auditors, we also should create employment in South Africa, and clearly from the fact that there's investment, it must generate financial stability in our market and provide the confidence investors to invest in the country. So indirectly, we're also responsible for economic growth. Auditors, when auditors perform an audit, they also look at compliance with laws and regulations. So clearly, it supports government and other regulators in ensuring that there's compliance and that any corruption or practices that are undesirable can be detected. Just a short, brief walkthrough to where we are at the moment. Those other entities on the slide represent regulators in other countries. The Financial Reporting Council in the UK, the PCAOB you might have heard of, is the US regulator. And every year the Global Competitive Report is issued by the World Economic Forum, and you might be aware that for 4 years in a row, South Africa has been rated number one out of about 134 countries for our strength of our auditing and reporting standards. And that's the sixth slide that says in New York, where there was a function, I think, at the South African Embassy, where they celebrated South Africa's ranking as number one in the world for four consecutive years. That is our global positioning and recognition from our counterparts internationally. Just about African landscape very briefly. When I talk about the issues that we have to face, transformation is one of them. So you'll see that of the approximately 4,300 audits in the country, you can see what the statistics look like, and actually we've got lots of work to do to transform the profession. We also approve auditors to issue BEE certificates, although there are verification agencies accredited by SANAS, the RBA itself accredited its own auditors to allow them to issue BEE certificates. There are about 260 of those. At any time, we have about 3,500 trainee auditors registered with us to produce those through their articles. And the number of auditors in relation to the number of chartered accountants in South Africa is about 4,300 compared to 57,000. Instead of giving you all the statistics about the disciplinary process and the disciplinary actions taken so far against auditors, I've taken one example of an auditor that was investigated and against which and against whom to disciplinary action. You'll see there what the charges were, just an example, and then what the fines were. The auditor was actually struck from the role of auditors and cannot apply for re-registration until 2019. At the same time, he was fined 400,000 rand and had to pay 500,000 rand in costs. We are aware, often when we meet auditors, auditors are one of our stakeholders, when we meet auditors, they are not aware that we know what issues they are facing, but we are aware of the issues that they are facing, and it doesn't mean that we shouldn't respond to those issues and at least see if there's any role that we need to play to support them. The first analysis is the five most important ones, Companies Act Impact. When the Companies Act was introduced 2 years ago, it had an impact on the audit landscape. And therefore, auditors have been affected by the auditors. Auditors complain about over-regulation. Remember, these are not our concerns, it's auditors' concerns that we are aware of. The challenges for small practices. Of our auditors, about two-thirds are made up of, come from the small and medium practices. The big four firms, the big five firms, only constitute about a third of our auditors. Auditors are concerned about the independence rules. Internationally, independence rules are being strengthened, but Africa cannot not respond to those international developments. But at the same time, we have to consider how relevant those independence rules are on South Africa. So again, we won't sluggishly adopt what the new independence rules are in Europe and the US. We will first consider what the impact is and how it applies to the African environment. And then translation for the firms are a problem. They are struggling to keep black auditors in the profession. The strategic matters on the RBA's agenda at the moment. 2 years ago, or at least last year, the previous Minister of Finance adopted the proposals from the World Bank to strengthen the accountancy and auditing profession. You might be aware of reports on the observance of standards and codes, we call it the ROSC. And in the ROSC there are various proposals to strengthen, further strengthen the accounting and auditing profession in South Africa. The World Bank comes into a country, and once the Minister of Finance has agreed that they can perform this exercise, they will then issue reports to the Minister. The Minister can adopt or not adopt the recommendations. One of the biggest recommendations in the ROSC at the moment is the regulation of accountants in addition to the regulation of auditors. So while 4,500 of the 37,000, well, there's 37,000 chartered accountants, but there's about 50,000 accountants in South Africa, while 4,300 are regulated because they're auditors, the ROSC now recommends that all 50,000 accountants should be regulated, and the Minister has to decide who the regulator should be for those accountants. I think it comes from our previous Minister of Finance, and even in his role as Tax Commissioner, the Minister was concerned that accountants and auditors were assisting their clients to avoid that. And while he was the Minister of Finance, he was also concerned that accountants were probably in the best position to assist their clients with financial affairs. And money laundering, etc., are also under the jurisdiction of the Minister of Finance, which is anti-money laundering. And therefore, the Minister had always had a strong feeling that those accountants should also be subject to regulation. We have a new training model in terms of international best practice, and because in South Africa we've realized that we need to consistently look at how we train auditors. Auditors can only be registered with the RBA if we are confident that they can go out and sign up on audit reports. And in terms of the changes in the profession, the landscape and the economy, and internationally, we believe that we needed a new training model in terms of which auditors are becoming more specialist accountants. So a chartered accountant is no longer automatically an auditor. You have to do and receive extra training to be recognized as an auditor because we believe it is a specialist. It is similar to the medical profession, not a general practitioner, it is a specialist. and they need special training for that. We have submitted amendments to our Orders and Profession Act to the National Treasury, and this is one area where the Treasury can assist us, about 2 years ago, to incorporate various changes, but also to incorporate the regulation of the Black Economic Empowerment Verification Industry as requested by the Minister of Trade and Industry. Those amendments haven't been approved, so we are unable to progress on in that area. Bearing in mind that the ARG has one mandate, and that is to regulate auditors. We cannot regulate the DE profession, and we cannot regulate independent reviewers, and we cannot regulate accountants until our legislation is changed. But we are dependent on national digital competition. Independence is a huge issue internationally, and a huge issue for the RBA, and a huge issue for myself. I'm concerned that I'm still having auditors on our board, and the board is meant to regulate auditors. We report to the board, and the board reports to the minister, and our board still has auditors on the board, which means that those auditors can still influence the regulator, which is supposed to regulate them. So, and I must say that it is a personal concern that I have as auditors are still. Sorry. Auditors are still influencing the regulator, and no matter how hard we try, they will also have their own agenda. So that is his concern, and it's one of the changes that is requested in our legislation, that there should be no auditors on the board. We do have an African strategy. We believe, and the World Bank and the National Treasury believe, that if we are recognized internationally for our standard setting and our regulation, that we should also have a role to play in Africa. So we do have a strategy to assist other countries, and have been approached by various countries in Africa to assist them with setting up independent audit regulation and to help them with adopting international standards. The regulation is a huge concern to us. The expectation is, and the DCI have already written it in their legislation, that the RBA is regulator. Our legislation has been amended, which means that we cannot regulate BEE. Only the auditors performing BEE services. But at the same time, it's created a lot of confusion in the market, unfortunately, because everybody's looking for a regulator, and there is no regulator for BEE. And then, of course, on the statistics, you could see the transformation remains a huge issue for the RBA and for the profession. That is just our board. Our board is appointed by the Minister of Finance, and we should give an indication of who's currently on our board. And then my last slide deals with our support to the ministry, our ministry, and the whole of government. Earlier I had a discussion on clean audits. What I've recommended to the Minister of Finance is that with RBA's clean audits for the last few years, that we should be positioned to also support other public entities that obtain clean audits. On that point, I also overheard when I came in that the comments that we should be very clear on what it is that we're trying to find in a clean audit. And while a clean audit report might be easy, there might still not be delivery on the ground. And it's interesting that my first meeting with the new Auditor General was exactly about that. The Auditor General did ask us to look at a model where the reports from the Auditor General in the public sector could become more relevant to the public, and not report on financial statements, only on performance information, but reports on things that are more relevant to the public and what should be relevant to Parliament. So it has requested us to look at that. Also bear in mind that the Auditor General is not regulated by the RBA. Doesn't mean that we work very closely with the Auditor General. There's a standing committee at the RBA where we issue guidance with the Auditor General on audits performed in the public sector. So unlike in other countries where there's no coordination and cooperation between the audit regulator and the Auditor General or Supreme Audit Institution, in South Africa we've always worked closely with the Auditor General. And I've just two examples of guidance that we've issued with the Auditor General's office to assist auditors who perform audits in the public sector. So we work very closely with them. We are often approached by other regulators, by other government departments who like to help them with guidance where they need reports from auditors, but they know exactly what they want. So we work closely with other departments to develop guidance with them. And then we do a quality control on the Auditor General's office, not because we have to, but because the Auditor General believes that they also, their quality of their audits should be checked. And annually, we spend about a month in the Auditor General's office just to do a quality control on their audit files. That is voluntary. The support that we believe we can provide to this specific committee, if there's any issues, and I hopefully can raise this and put on the agenda through a strategic session, is that we can advise on any matters relating to audit and any other assurance. We can track international relevance for the committee, and we can improve the quality of submissions too, and anything that the committee debates at this level, if there's any need from us to support the committee in that respect, we will be very happy to do so. Another example is our minister regularly goes to the G20 meeting, and we believe that we can also support the minister in preparing him for those meetings when it comes to audit policy, because we haven't done so in the past. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you very much.
First of all, congratulations for your number one position for your position. However, I reject and I must say, you have signed the South African Ministry of Finance for all this absolutely successful. We are 2 years into democracy and we only have 9% left out of 28% white and black. If you were a black person and you had to be able to take it, you feel more like the you from the white children, you expect justice to arise out of it. I think something that I appear must really they need to seriously address. The other thing that I wish to find out from you is that when it comes to forensic audits, they have to be auditors to be registered first before they can be forensic auditors. And the reason why I say that is because the independent, this versus record that we have internationally, our lab is to protect and journalists. Because some of the trends that we are beginning to observe is that when the auditor, their independence is becoming more and more questionable. Because when somebody has an issue, whether it could be an individual, it could be somebody, or maybe want to keep somebody out, or something like that, they are very quick to actually go and, engage some auditing firm that will really be looking for all the, they dig out those things. No, there's nothing wrong with getting out the wrong, but I am saying the money becomes very important. And I think given this landscape as well, it begins to space and it's a bit of the wider. The other thing that I also wanted to find out is about you are saying we have about 50,000 registered social accounts. Now, obviously they have their own board. They are registered. So I'm talking about their own board. They are registered. And if they qualify, would it mean that if they write whatever board exams, I don't know what they have to go through, they go through the training and probably write board exams with you and they get registered. If maybe this chartered accountant gets, for one reason or the other, gets struck off from the board of chartered accountants, would it mean that this person is going to be automatically struck off from the board and this side? And I certainly do think that probably it's a matter that this committee should have to seriously look at, because I think South Africa, I'm also feeling that we are really, I actually sympathize with the auditors. I think we are really over-regulating. I think we are guilty of over-regulating. If we are regulating even something that shouldn't necessarily be regulated, but it's something that's got to do with ethics, basically. It's more of how to do something, and you threaten to even push that space, and I think it's something that we could play a role in that one. And finally, I wanted to check your board. How has it been Treasury's response to your proposal? Because to me, I do see a good use of interest You can't have all the cells sitting in your board, and they are meant to be regulating the very industry. And obviously, I would imagine that they also have their own auditing firm. And maybe you, this is why you will end up with the monopoly of some auditing firms that are really monopolizing every aspect of business, be it private or public. I'm not going to say they are. But it is a well-known fact that you have a very a small group that is monopolizing the business in that sector. And probably the answer is what you have alluded to here, to say even the composition of the board affair. Now, I want to know what has been the reaction of National Treasury to that, because it's something that the composition of the board is very important. Not even the lack of transformation, you might actually find that some, it could be attributed to the fact that so your composition maybe is, although it might be having a few things, let's say here and there, but you will find that they, you know, this is such, I don't like to be too human, but one of them are unfortunate.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. I think I welcome the presentation as made. I think there are two things that I don't want us to miss as a committee, which we would really want to address. One is around the legislation that needs to be amended with the PAO2. Two is around outstanding accountants that need to be regulated, which the minister also which has a bearing on, or which the minister has to also authorize something like that. So those are some of the things that as a committee will also have to follow up and relate how we support on some of those things. The important thing is what my colleague here, Honorable Makosi, spoke to, the independence of the research. You must accept that we are liking this new Makosi. I think he is liking this. And I want to bring this dimension. I want to bring this dimension to IRBA. What is the record for government officials, especially CFOs and accounting officers? If they feel that the AG was unfair with the political team, you know, sometimes, and I'll give you a practical example. Remember, PFMA also over and above the accounting officer having to be hands-on and responsible on the audit activity. The executive also has a role to play in some of those things. And I had that opportunity at some point to be an accounting officer. So you would, at some point, the AG rep in a particular department will come in with management letters going forth and forth between the officials and the department and the AG's office. And at some time when the AG is searched for time, that's where some of the management letters come through. And the officials will be saying, but let's go outside so that you're able to see some of the things and see understand that what you are alleging is not what you are saying on the ground. And the AG would say, no, I'm just for time, I'm giving an opinion, and it's something else that officials, and they see it, they've been treated unfairly. And what becomes the record in that case? And remember, in some instances, accounting, the accountants from the AG office play in the public domain and they get influenced by topical issues. That's what people sometimes perceive it to be. So where you have that independence, great question. How do, what is the recourse, whether for the public or for the officials in that regard? Because that way we want to see the independence of the office of the police. But the other thing, you know, there's this perception by the general public, but also by officials in department, that AG is somebody who has started with to crack on all officials. But then on the high side, I mean, between me and you, we know that the internal audit that is put in place by department. And these are officials of the department who also do internal auditing, even before the AG comes. So why is the perception of the AG so negative as opposed to the perception on the internal audit capacity? Is there something wrong that departments are doing, or the level of attention that is given to the AG? Why is it so paramount that it is not given to the internal audit? Because internal audit can actually improve. So I was saying, you know, people must see, our officials in departments must see internal audit as a mechanism that is able to mitigate even before the AG comes as an independent body to come and do audit, so that they complement each other on some of these things. So I thought those are the things that you should look at. So in my own way of understanding your role, I want to do what the previous chairperson of what is it? Should I see IRBA and for the purpose of the chair, independent complaint directorate of the police? I know they have a name. You know that body that also oversees the activities of police, ICD? So IRBA, you are something like that.
Yeah.
You are something like that. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
Doesn't mean nothing. You have to do something new. You're going to Maybe my question is not
Can I just start with one question? And I'm going to speak without looking in because you are right, just look at this.
Yeah, but you see, they need for recording.
Oh,
you
have
to
okay.
Yeah.
Okay, it's going to be
off. I don't know what recording is, what is it like
minutes. Oh, PMG, they take the recording. You see the recording is a lot. I thought they are kind of the
no, they are the agents, any agents, because they record anything you say, even the nonsense. Yeah, expose the public delay. So why are we not getting any agents there? Yeah, I don't know what you mean. As I was before 2009, TMG made some making change, by the
way. Why is TMG?
How do you want to do? They do minutes of meetings, right? Then you put it on your website. They're taken very seriously by a wide range of stakeholders. And you see why I'm trying to get the names of respect. I'm not going to talk to that guy here. Often commissions change before 2008, I don't think it's okay. These two look at a TMG minister, not a minister of the committee. Okay. So the TMG minister of best policy, they're going to make it. Obviously, the TMG minister you got, you're so not a good thing.
Thank you. It is actually the PMG minute that we used to prepare for this meeting today.
So
we know that members are staying in Parliament and what their views are.
So you're not
the Thanks, Chair. I will then, to honour the Chief to answer these questions.
No, if you think that questions that here are a thematic part, but not because there's no such thing as a rule.
But,
there's no rule system. Is there a rule? No. So you're asking how you think.
I think those are valuable to put in there.
I think those are valuable. What is it that we haven't got at all? Because I'm not allowed to do it. And the committee, see, I'm a 2 years ago. Well, 4 years ago,
something like several years of internal review for some time. One thing more important is the fact that after 6 years, just giving me nothing. I can't put my brand over there.
In terms of invitations to study, if I think that a question is not valid, I'm going to put that one last.
Yeah.
The location of the award.
Thank
you. Thank you, Chair and members, for the questions. I will then take it in the same sequence as I received them. And a lot of the questions, some of the members had the same questions, so I'll deal with it at the same time. The one is transformation. And I start with a chair question on the RDA's role in transformation. And if we distinguish between the role of a professional body and an accredited body, at the moment the RDA only has one accredited body, and that's the South African Institute of Chartered Accountants, or SICA. That's the only professional body that we accredit and whose members can become auditors, because they are the only body whose members comply with the requirements to become auditors. And we are looking at accrediting maybe other organizations like the ACCA, there are a couple of other professional bodies. The responsibility of transformation in the profession is the responsibility of the professional body. The RDA is a regulator. We do not have a mandate to transform. We don't have a vice to transform. We shouldn't be involved in transformation. In our model to accredit a body, one of the requirements is that they transform. Bearing in mind that those 37,000 chartered accountants, which is our pipeline, in their accreditation model, to retain their accreditation, they have to demonstrate to us that they are transforming the profession. So that is really where responsibility actually lies. However, our board sees it though, realize that as a public entity, we cannot just sit back and wait for the professional body to drive transformation, and they've done that through the SUCA project, which you must have heard of, and we've got our own charter. There's a CA charter that is gazetted. So along with the other sectors who have gazetted charters, the CA profession also has a charter. The RBA is a signatory to that charter. I serve on that committee, so we influence what happens in transformation in the pipeline of those that come through to register as auditors. And that is really what our involvement should be. 2 years ago, the board decided to form a transformation committee. So we've got our own transformation committee with our own project. We don't have funding for it, so we are trying to raise funding for this project. And we have, for example, applied to PACIS to obtain funding for specific projects. In fact, at this very moment, I was supposed to be in our transformation committee meeting, because they are talking about the 4 or 5 most received projects that we have to take forward. We are also not going to try and fund prospective auditors to go to university to give them accommodation. That is, we don't have money for that. All we can do is try to influence transformation. And we do that by seeing whether we need to work with very strategic stakeholders to see where we can make a difference. But we do have projects, we do have a committee. We've taken some of our money to fund that committee. And we've also asked national strategies to provide us some of their funding. It's not in our budget, because it's not in our mandate. But the committee has existed for 2 years. We've got two subcommittees. The one deals with the experience of students at university. That's called the education subcommittee. And the one deals with the article clerk at the firms, because the firms are still facing challenges, or clerks, black clerks at firms are still facing challenges as black article clerks. When I talk to the profession about transformation, I explain to them, and I'm just answering another question of yours, Chair. I am a chartered accountant and I was an auditor, but I'm not an auditor in public practice. And there's a difference between somebody with an auditing qualification and somebody that's actually practicing as an auditor, and that's a different type of issue. So when I was doing my articles more than 2 years ago, there were transformation issues. I was the first black clerk in an office in one of the big four, and it was difficult. And 25 years later, the clerks are facing the same problems. When we talk to them, they face the same problems. So we are planning a survey to find out exactly what the root causes are, and then trying to address that with the firms. And as the regulator of the firms, we will then request or force the firm to do something about transformation. So the role of the retailer will be by using almost our regulated stick to ensure that they do carry out transformation, and that they put in place initiatives to retain costs. But we'll work together with the firms. We're not going to just monitor them and say that they haven't complied. And one of the objectives of the Transformation Committee is to, when we do inspections, to also get feedback on their firms are complying with the CA charter. and how the information that they report. Because the firms have to report in terms of the CHR to the DTI whether they've met their targets that we set for ourselves. But we don't know if the information is correct. And again, the role that the RBA will play is when you do an inspection, we will see whether we haven't worked out the details, but we will see how we can report back on that information and transformation. The transformation committee is going very strong. It is chaired by Ms. Violeta Gabordo. She was the first black PA female, and she's very passionate about it, and I think she's the right person to chair the committee. The question on forensic auditors. Forensic auditors are not registered with the RDA. They have no regulator. Anybody can be a forensic auditor. And there's no professional body to which they belong. I think there is an institute for forensic auditors, and they have approached us to form a regulator because the forensic auditing profession is not regulated. You don't have to be an auditor and a chartered accountant to be a forensic auditor. But the institute has approached me on several occasions to find out how they can set themselves up as a regulator because they understand that that specific profession needs to be regulated. I agree with a member that often forensic audits or investigations are performed for the wrong reasons. We often get requests from government departments, from senior people about forensic investigations, but we will not. Participate in any process where we know that it is used for the wrong reason. And when an audit is involved and that the audit is used for that purpose, we will also not participate or encourage any of those processes, which means that we have to perform an initial investigation to find out whether there is any merit in any case. If it's a registered auditor, of course, and the auditor was involved in any investigation, then it becomes the RDA's business. But they are not regulated at this stage. When chartered accountants, all chartered accountants, the 37 chartered accountants, you have to be a CA before you can be a registered auditor. And the agreement that we have with the institute, SICA, the South African Institute of Chartered Accountants, is a professional body. It's a body that we created, but they're a professional body, a membership body, and we refer to them, and they don't like us saying it, as a trade union for CA, but they're a member body. We are the regulators, so we've got a very different relationship with those CAs that are auditors. The agreement that we have is that if a chartered accountant is also an auditor, only 4,500 of them will be auditors as well. If they're also an auditor and there's any complaint or charge against them, that we will run the investigation and they will rely on our results. So if that person is a CA, they want to have an investigation, they'll wait for the RBA to perform their investigation. And whatever sanctions we pass, they will then adopt those sanctions because they are confident that we have gone through a thorough process. So that's how the sanctioning of CAs work that are also auditors. Overregulation, I also agree with a member that it's really the overregulation that you are going to start seeing about mostly about rotation of audit firms. And about audit firms not performing audits and other services. We agree that's important for independence, but there are ethics issues. It's the overregulation that we're talking about are related to, or auditors are concerned about, are really around ethical issues. And this is important, so even though auditors believe that being overregulated, we feel we don't only issue auditing standards, we also issue the code of ethics for auditors. And therefore, if it's an ethical issue, the RBA has to address it. And we haven't decided in South Africa whether we want audit firms to rotate internationally. They rotate not only the auditor, but also the audit firm. We believe that we still have to see how it will work in South Africa, but we might have to implement that as well. But the issues are, the overregulation is around ethics. So the Companies Act, for example, says that if you do the audits, you also can't perform other services. And we believe that that is correct, because what auditors often do is they spend 5% of their time and fee on audit, and 95% on consulting. And we're not interested in the consulting that they do, we're only interested in audit, because audit is a public function, and that is where we need to set public, and that's where we require quality. We don't require quality in tax, and I'll come to the tax question, but we're not a tax regulator at this stage, or the accounting regulator, or the audit regulator. So if an auditor performs a poor audit, that is where our interest lies. So the regulation is in mostly in ethics, but it's also because other international bodies like the PCAOB, if they have any auditor that's an auditor of a subsidiary listed on the stock exchange in the US, then they can also inspect that auditor. If it's a company listed in Europe somewhere, then they can also inspect that auditor. And so they feel regulated not only by the RBA but by other international regulators as well. What we're busy doing is to set up agreements with those regulators to say that they can rely on us as a regulator and they don't have to also regulate those auditors because it does become too much for the auditor. They spend half their time preparing for inspection. We've entered into an agreement with Europe. We're one of the 10 countries that Europe has adopted and is accepted as a reputable regulator, but the US will not accept us as credible until we have no auditors on our board. And unless that changes, the U.S. will continue to do inspections on productive processes. Maybe I should also deal with Twin Peaks model, because I'm talking about regulation. And Sherry, I'm not part of the Twin Peaks model. We were deliberately excluded because we should be independent. And so both sectors that are forming at this stage, between the FSB and the Reserve Bank, the RBA has been deliberately excluded because of our independence. And that's what I think is the government is. The board, response to auditors on our board, we have raised it with Treasury. Part of our changes to the legislation that we've requested is that we don't have any auditors on the board. And a very valid question that is asked by everybody else is how can we regulate auditors if we don't have auditing experience? What the World Bank report suggests and what we suggest is that we should strengthen our internal capacity. We have to have capable, competent people in the organization. We're 70 employees. They're highly skilled professionals. They're CEOs and ex-auditors. So they're not infectious. The important thing is that we cannot have somebody that's a partner at one of the big four sitting on the board. I'm not saying that they have genders, but perception and possibility exists that they could have their own genders. So they shouldn't be in public practice. If they're tired, they've got experience, that's fine. So we can have desired partners, we should have a cooling off period. But the most important thing to us is to strengthen our capacity internally. I want strong investigators, I want strong inspectors, I don't want to rely on the audit firms to support us because then we're not independent. We should be competent enough and skilled enough to advise the board, and the board must be able to rely on us and trust us enough to be able to take decisions, although the board might not be audited. So that is one way that we can address it. And the World Bank report also speaks to strengthening the capacity at the RBA. One of their first comments was also that we are well undercapacitated for what we have to deliver on, so it means that 70 staff members are stretched. And to come back to the funding requirements, we have a budget of about 70 million rand a year, which is north 1% of the national budget. It's very, very small. Government gives us 1/3. We receive 1/3 from registration fees, and we receive 1/3 from performing inspections. We cannot inspect an auditor and let auditor pay us because it affects our independence. So we have to move away from that model. When we approach government to give us more money, or Treasury to give us more money to become independent and not collect any money from auditors, we were told that they are going to take away the 1/3 as well, and that we need to become self-funded. So we're working on a model at the moment to raise our own funding, because we're not just getting money from Treasury, although Treasury has established us. But it's not a problem. We'll work on a model to see how we can raise funding and still carry out our mandate. But our budget is roughly 70 million per annum, of which more than 50% of course goes into employee stock. The issue about, I think it's before there was raised the issue on the firms which might influence what happens in the profession. There's a bigger issue, and that is concentration in the market. One of our big issues is that there is market concentration in order to set. There's a big four internationally, there's a big five in South Africa now. We are concerned that if one of those firms fail, that there will be huge consequences in South Africa. We can't have one of those big four firms or big five firms go through an audit failure. So it's important that we don't lose the concentration of the firms. We want other firms to also participate in the pie. And one of our strategies is not only to, and you see on our list of issues, we've got small and medium practices. One of our strategies, not necessarily to dilute the Big Four, but to strengthen the SEP, the small and medium firms. We're trying to get those firms to get together and form bigger firms, or trying to strengthen them, or trying to get them to build capacity so that they can compete with the big five firms, and that we can't have concentration. The moment you have concentration in the market, you can have monopoly. And the moment you have monopoly, you have all the quality that is not at the level that you want. The Big Four can easily say that everybody uses them, so they don't have to worry about what is quality, and that will affect the demands that the public can have on their 44. So it's important that we address the concentration in the market. I think if I can then go on to the final questions. The incentives of the board I talked about, we talked about the amendment of the legislation, again, and the chairman's commitment to respond to communication. We will draft that communication within the next less than 48 hours and get that to you. The regulation of accountants, we believe that we have been, our challenge has been, and I didn't want to talk about challenges to the committee, but our challenge at this stage is that we're preparing budgets, but we're not sure whether we will be regulating BEE or regulating accountants. We believe that it's important that it's regulated. It doesn't have to be the RBA. We want to position ourselves to become the regulator. If the minister wants us to do that, we have already set ourselves up. We know what to do. We presented the minister with a plan to regulate BEE and to regulate accountants, but the minister can decide, anybody can do, can become the regulator. If you want us to do it, we are prepared to do it, and we've got the strategy already, and they have presented that to the minister. The CFO recalls when the Auditor General is seen to be unfair, and again, it's very interesting because 2 weeks ago, the minister had a meeting with all the heads of public entities, so there's quite a few of us around the table, and the same concern is raised by those entities to say that they're not happy with the way that the Auditor General approaches the audit. We don't regulate the Auditor General, so we cannot tell the Auditor General what to do. But because we engage with the Auditor General, we can bring certain questions to attention. What I agreed at that meeting was that we will prepare a paper for the Minister and for the Ministry of Finance that they can share with Parliament to explain exactly what the role is of the Accountant General, of the HD as the standard setter, of the National Treasury in interpreting standards and legislation and regulations, and of the Auditor General in interpreting standards and regulation and policy, because I think a lot of the concern from the auditees comes from the fact that the Auditor General seems to think that they can issue an opinion on standards or on regulations or on policy, and the Treasury thinks that they are the ones that should be deciding on policy. But there's a lot of confusion about the role, so we have already prepared a paper as we'll send to National Treasury, they're meeting with them this morning, to discuss the role of each one, and so that we can also support the public entities and auditees, so that when somebody tries to give them an opinion or disagrees with them, that they can say, this is your role, that is not your role, this is who you should speak to, this is who they should speak to as CFOs, and get the support from them. So we've done that paper already, and hopefully that will come to Parliament, or that's one way where you can use us or call on us to assist you. So we've done that already. The independence of the Auditor General staff, again, I would not respond to that because they're not under our jurisdiction. Yeah. And similarly, the Institute of Internal Auditors, the professional body that looks after internal audits, is not under our jurisdiction. But we do have a good relationship with the Institute of Internal Auditors, and when we find things, support from auditors on the lack in internal audits or no reliance on internal audits, we address that to the Institute CEO. And she's aware that they need to strengthen their qualification and their oversight over internal auditors to ensure that they can deliver strong, better internal audit departments if that is a problem. But what the RBA is doing at the same time, internal audit is just one part of governance. Governance consists of lots of other role players like audit committees. And we should, in addition to strengthening internal audits, should also ensure that audit committees are strengthened. In other countries, they rely a lot on the audit committees to pick up issues before the Auditor General can pick it up. And they allow internal audits. But that means that those stakeholders must be qualified and competent to do so. And in South Africa, we might not have that competence, but we must also play a role in seeing how we can strengthen audit committees and also internal audits. And it means that we get assigned auditors to support them and to assist them, and that's a role that we can be playing as a regulator. up and then move on to maybe some writing questions on tax compliance. Just give you some background to that as well. The previous Minister of Finance again wanted all tax practitioners to be regulated, and we believe that it's time soon. We believe that there's a lot of malpractices happening in tax. If they're not audited, they're not regulated, so it should be regulated. The Minister's plan was to provide an 18-month period during which certain organizations were appointed as a sort of supervisory body where their members are checked by them and where they have their members have to register with them as tax practitioners. So for example, if an auditor is also a tax practitioner, they have to register with the RDA or the institute as a tax practitioner so we know who they are and who's performing tax. So that is what the Minister's plan was. There's quite a few bodies that are allowed to have oversight over tax practitioners. His idea was also to go back to his original plan. If those supervisory bodies don't perform the functions, and he gave a period of 18 months, he will then appoint a super regulator to look at all tax practitioners. And again, I know he mentioned that the RBA can do that, but it's still the Minister's decision. But tax practitioners at this stage are only, they have oversight from their professional bodies, but not from a regulator. And his idea is to have a regulator appointed to supervise the body do not perform their functions. The cost to small and medium practices, they are saying that it is rather costly for them. The legislation, like the companies, have certain objectives, good objectives, but in the end I think there has to be a cost exercise, and that wasn't really done to see what the cost impact would be. And some of the concerns are that it has become, instead of making it easier for the SMC, small and medium practices to operate, it's become more difficult for them because the costs are increased. There are increased costs. And I can't tell exactly where they are because I'm not in practice, but there has been some said that legislation has made it more costly to operate instead of making it less costly. Then the question on the international regulation and standard setting. We have been participating in international structures for many years, and I think it has put us in good stead. But the board decision now, one of our four main objectives is to get more involved in the region. So our strategy now, we will continue to participate in international structures and influence what happens there. We don't go to committee meetings and listen to what they say. We members of those meetings. We influence those meetings. We influence the outcome. This year, the International Federation of Accountants issued the Audit Quality Framework. I myself serve on that committee. I ensure that framework is drafted in public interest and not in the auditor's interest. So on most of the committees, we actually influence what they do. We are there to ensure, because we adopted those standards, we have input into it. The World Bank believes that we should be playing a bigger role in Africa. Chile believes that, and the board believes that. So we have now got a strategy to... The World Bank has asked us to put together a plan for how we are going to support other countries in Africa. We've been approached by many countries. I've been to Botswana, I've been to Lesotho, I think it's Nigeria that invited us to come and help them. So we are spending a lot of time helping those countries and get involved. But the World Bank will actually give us funding if we can give them a plan how we are going to support them. It's not in our budget, and Treasury won't fund us. Treasury does have a budget for Africa, but we don't have part of that. So we will raise funding from the World Bank to be able to do so. The details of overregulation, I think, is from an international perspective. It's from the fact that tax practitioners need to be regulated, accounting are regulated. If you are a accountable institution in terms of the fee legislation, you are regulated. So it's just actually a general feeling that there's too much regulation and businesses. Auditors are also businesses, and they feel that they, instead of focusing on their business, they are more trying to construct regulation. But we don't believe that regulation is not important. We believe it's very important. We just need to know when to actually, or where to draw the line. And the regulation is not only from the RBA, there's complaints from regulation from different organizations and from different regulators. I think in my last question I need to answer is on the tracking of international development and how we can support the committee. And I'll go back to the slide that I've had. The suggestion that was made about us being available if the committee starts bank's annual reports, through audit reports, through the audit general's reports, through any issues that the audit general has raised, that is an area we can support the committee. We understand audit reports. The audit report is our report that the audit journal uses. It wants to change it to become more relevant, as one of the members mentioned in the previous session, that it's no use reporting on financials but there's no delivery. Audit journal is working on that, and we're going to work with him on that. We can assist with those kind of developments. If the committee wants us to put together a plan or strategy, because we haven't really thought in detail about it, we can do that. But we just need the committee to be aware that we are here to support them. International development, we work closely with other regulators. The PCB, for example, has a department specifically for all the groups that gather market intelligence on what happens in the economies around the world. And we link into that, and we can also support the committee with it. The committee has a question on what is happening in any specific industry, because if a member of parliament raises the question, we can try and give us access and tap into that information internationally, because of international involvement. And then again, submissions that the committee receives, I'm not familiar with those. We can just support the committee if we have a board for children. I think that the last one was PAs are increasing, and the number of accountants I'm not aware of that they are increasing, but the reason why the auditors aren't increasing is exactly because of the perception over regulation and the risks involved. Auditors like to use risk. Our own legislation says if an auditor doesn't do certain things, the penalty is not only striking him from the register, but an auditor can go to jail for 10 years or can find 10 million rand in terms of our act if they don't do certain things. And young CAs are not very risk averse. They rather get a job where they can get more money, not lose money, or go to jail. So I think it's also the perception that it's going to affect this. Audit outcomes. Why audit outcomes are poor when we are number one in the world? I think the fact that we are number one in the world is the very reason why we get the outcomes that we have. If we didn't, the audit must be reliable. The outcome of the audit must be reliable. If it's a qualified report or unqualified report, the important aspect is that it must be able to rely on the report. And if the public and government can't rely on whether the report should be a clean report or should be a qualified report, it means that the auditor didn't do it well properly. It is exactly because of high quality of our auditing standards that we are in a position to report accurately whether a client or an auditee has failed an audit or whether they've got a clean audit report. So I say that it is important that we do have high quality standards to be able to get to the best result. If we didn't have that and we wouldn't get it, then we wouldn't be able to rely on whether the audit standards results are actually correct. So I say that they are very close to them. And I think I've already mentioned that, yes, the people in the RGA have to be qualified, and the question is whether I myself am an auditor. I was an auditor, and I've covered that. And then finally, Chair, I thank you for the invitation to write to you about getting our legislation fast track. It's very important for us, and also to write a letter to you on what we can do to support the community.
And what
do you think
is
this? I want to
see I'm sorry, I just have a point here that I think it's going to be very important for this community to probably start engaging the minister on. You know, I don't know whether I'm England based, but I have been part of your time and fund industry previously. And I know what happens with these regulatory bodies that you are saying you cannot fund from the national system, but at the same time you are expecting them to be independent. And I think it's something that we really need to seriously interrogate, because I know for one, I mean, you would know that FSP, for example, they have these exams that they are running, they're trying to raise funds in whichever way they can. And they end up not focusing on what they are supposed to be focusing on. They end up working more on revenue generation. And obviously, you know, your financial services industry would remain untransformed because these people are not absolutely independent. they are right great things, but they still human rights behind this. It's just exceeding. And I think it's the same with I think if we are currently age to be independent, we ought to move away and be as a common community. This neoliberal approaches to, you know, all the time we keep on saying, no, we are people must find a way of revenue. Government must accept that there are those functions that we have to fund from the national fiscal. It's part of defending our democracy. I think this might be absolutely important that we begin engaging with the minister in respect of that. You don't think we want them to be independent. We cannot. Yes, they will try to be independent, but if you are going to be doing inspection, I mean, on one firm, all the systems, and then you are saying, pay me. I mean, it's way your independence there. What is your independence? If the person is saying, okay, I will pay you more provided to do A, B, C, D, E. So the whole good story that we have, that we are telling the whole world, being number one and so forth, is going to go away. So I think we need to look at that. But the other thing that I wanted to say, I concur. I wanted to say that when Mark is raising the issues about the misogyny or the soaking or this or whatever, I am one person that I can concur with what he is saying. I think there is a very clear correlation between what the Auditor General pronounces and the public view of the services that are being delivered. The weaknesses, the poor quality of services that are delivered, and what the AG is saying, there is a direct relationship. That is why we have so much public discourse. Yesterday we saw that it's about Patrick, where Peter Patrick was saying, over the past few years, the change on public, on political answers and so forth has gone up. Hence we have not achieved the clean audit that we have put out of the target of clean audit by 2014. And if you look at that, and you look at the change of software in society, and you're looking at the members, the feeling of the members to public audit house, you can see there is a relationship. And I guess you, I think it's precisely because we are adhering to those standards.
This one is that it's not something that happened overnight. We started in about 1994. We started a process where we started to sort of harmonize our standards with international standards, because if the international community needs to know what standards they are looking at when they look at the financial systems from South Africa, they don't have to worry about those are South African standards and don't know what they are. So the first thing we did was we harmonized the international and the local standards. And then we also at the same time harmonized public sector standards with the private sector standards. I was working for the Auditor General at the time, and my responsibility was to ensure that our local standards were the same as, first of all, the private sector standards, or public and private. And then when I moved on to the Institute, it was to ensure that our international standards are the same as the local. But it's not because of that. Somebody at the previous RBA, the PAAD, had the foresight to know that we have to globalize, we have to harmonize, we have to understand that we're operating in one financial market, there's no more borders. And it doesn't matter where you sit, you must know what standards are being used. And by adopting those international standards, we were one of the first adopters of the international standards on auditing. In 2005 we adopted, but the process started in 2004. At least in 2005 we adopted it, we started the process in 1994. And the reason also when even international organizations ask us and other regulators, why is it that we could adopt the international standard easily? Was because in 1994, the country itself went through so much change that adopting international standards was a small matter. There was no patriotic pride or saying we have to have our own standards. We were in a time of change. Whereas in other countries like France and the UK, they are so patriotic about their standards that they've been moved to global standards. So it's those kind of changes that I think supported us quite a bit. And then to respond to your last question, I think you should get an award for the 4 years. I think you should get that.
Thank you very much indeed. You would write to us and you will tell us
Thank you. Yeah.
I always shop on the phone, whatever.
Yeah. Thank you.